Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the 343 podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today, we're going to talk about something practical, something that coaches really need to know and do in their training sessions, and something that the ecosystem as a whole should be more aware of. They are rondos, and the most fundamental of all technical skills, which is receiving across the body. Now, I would think that today in 2025, we wouldn't have to be talking about this stuff. I would have thought that by now, everybody would at least have had the fundamentals down, but it's not true. I see it on a daily basis online, coaches or other people who don't even coach talking about rondos not being a good thing to do in your training environments. They are not directional, or they are limiting, or there's too many restrictions, or you name it. And it already rings alarm bells, red flags all over the place, because none of those things are true. And some of the things that technically you can say are factually correct, they are missing the entire big picture and the entire context of the training methodology that kind of started, or at least made very, very popular by Johan Cruyff. So I guess they're saying that Johan Cruyff was very incorrect in the way that he would train over there in Holland, over there in Barcelona and elsewhere, and that his protégés, like say Xavi Hernandez or Pep Guardiola himself, are also incorrect in how they train their teams. And it's not just pro teams, mind you. This is a philosophy and a methodology that stems from the youngest of ages. So we really need to get back to basics, guys. And that's what Benny decided to talk about today. I think it's a good one. So hold on to your hats. Here we go with rondos and receiving across the body. But first, coaches, I mean, you don't just have to hear the audio. You can actually go over to 343coaching.com and enlist yourselves in the free or premium programs there, coaching education programs, that is. And you can actually see the activity being executed properly by somebody who is a craftsman at this stuff and somebody who pioneered a seismic shift in American soccer. His name is Brian Kleiben, and it is not scripted. You get to witness him on the actual training grounds with his actual teams and actual players. Don't let another 1, 2, 5, 10 years go by, and then you look back and you're like, oh my gosh, I should have learned these things way back when, and I'd be that much farther along in my coaching journey. So again, 343coaching.com is for you coaches. If you're in the 7-versus-7 format, 7v7coaching.com is where to go. And parents, the education is just as critical for you and not just for coaches. So for you, we've codified decades worth of experience from yours truly at 343masterclass.com. All right, here we go.
All right, dude, well, let's get into our stuff today. Been a minute, Gary, since we talked about the masterclass. We did a whole series on the philosophy side of it and kind of like the mental lessons and, you know, what goes into the mentality of the player, things like that. Within the 343 masterclass parent education program, there's a whole section on the tactical, right? And so you have lessons such as receiving across the body, rondos, building out of the back, losing your man, cambio de ritmo, attacking patterns. So I wanted to, I don't know if it would be better to kind of go through each one, or maybe each one can be its own episode, but I think it'd be good to talk about kind of what was your process in coming up with these lessons, and why did you feel that adding the tactical section to this program would be beneficial to not only the parents, but the players. So let's start, Gary, start simple with the first one, right? And this is something that probably gets ignored within a lot of teams and a lot of coaches, a fundamental component of the game, receiving across the body. I played soccer, Gary, for 12 years before I ever heard this concept, right? And the first day that I joined Brian's team, you know, this is something that he was instilling in me from day one. And ever since then, I mean, if you watch any high level game, you're going to notice this small but crucial detail. And I think a lot of coaches, especially if they're new or they haven't been around the game a while, it's something that often goes unnoticed or even untalked about. So, you know, what is the importance of receiving across the body? And yeah, let's just start there, Greg.
Got it. First, let's just a brief description of what we mean by that. So if a player is going to receive a pass and say it's coming from the right side, then you let the ball cross in front of you and you stop it with, or you control it with your left foot. If the ball is coming from the left side, you let the ball traverse the length of your body and you control it with your right foot. So that's why we say receive across the body. Now the English and the Anglo, in the Anglo world, they would say something like back foot. That's the terminology that they utilize. But it's interesting because, so you gave your experience when you came to Brian's team. That was one of the most fundamental things, because it is one of the most fundamental things in all of football, because it affords you, the player receiving the ball, a lot more capability of control, number one. And number two, when you actually control the ball, your body posture and positioning is such that you are equipped to view the entire panorama of the field. And secondly, on your second touch after your first touch control is right in front of the ball, is right in front of you, and you're capable of executing a subsequent action, be it a pass forward, be it a pass to the right, be it a pass to the left, or be it to dribbling or taking whatever action you want. So this technique is one that affords the most control of them all. Interestingly, the players who sometimes violate that most of the time are the hyper outlier level world-class type like Neymar. So you might see Neymar receiving the ball with the outside of his foot, you know what I'm saying? Or doing something fancy with it, or stopping it with his heel. And that's okay if you're Neymar, okay? Because he has other things in mind. He's at a completely different level compared to everybody else. And him stopping it that way enables him to execute other operations, for instance, that he wants to execute. But a player that is not on Neymar's level is not capable of executing those other outrageously high level operations. So it would be stupid to stop it like how Neymar does. And here in the United States, growing up and up to and including, you know, to the point where Brian, you know, kind of brought this home from Barcelona when he had his internships with FC Barcelona over there under Luis Enrique's time. Until he brought that home, I also was unaware of how crucial and important a thing this was. So for folks out there, and you wanted to make this about the master class, which is parent education, but this is also important for everybody, coaches, and even just fans who want to judge whether a player is good or not good or something. Observe in a game, in a professional match, how players receive, and they'll receive it across the body almost 90% of the time. That is the correct way to do it. And if you don't establish that from the get-go, all the other stuff, all the other lessons that come later, the other techniques, the tactical, everything, it will be broken if you don't have this fundamental thing under your belt, Benny. So that's why I put it in there. And also, one of the frustrations and the impetus for starting the parent education is because you see online how the American base rates players and who they think is good and who they think is not good. And who they've historically thought was a good player is a trash player because they don't even have the base fundamentals, you know, underneath them. So for instance, they might say, oh, Jordan Morris, when he was coming up, right, is a world-class talent or something stupid like this. And the reason that they have those sorts of judgments in error is because they don't even see the foundational stuff, Ben. So we have to start parents and coaches off with the foundational stuff, and that is receiving across the body.
Yeah. A couple of things, Gary. You mentioned Neymar as a player that sometimes does that. I always notice Mo Salah. This guy's always receiving the ball with his left foot, like no matter where it comes from. But his first touch is just so clean, and he knows exactly what he's doing. Like one of the kids on my team, like obviously I teach him this concept, and the kid, Mo Salah, is his favorite player. He's like, coach, I see him doing it all the time. He's not receiving across his body. I'm like, well, he's different. Dude, he's that special type of player that just knows what he's doing. But it's funny that you mentioned also, Gary, that this is a concept that you hadn't heard of until Brian brought it over. I'm wondering, though, if when you were a young player, did you kind of naturally do it without even knowing that you were doing it? Because obviously you guys watch so many pro games. I mean, you see the top level players in the world. Do you think that you were doing it without even realizing it? And then when you did realize, obviously, by the time you realized, Gary, you weren't a player anymore. But, you know, when you did realize, did it kind of just open your eyes into like, holy shit, a massive concept that I should have learned from the second I started playing?
100%, Benny. So when I think back, and when I would think back, once I realized this is a massive thing that I went completely untaught to me, most of the time, if the ball is coming from the left, I would receive it with the right because I'm right-footed across the body. But when the ball is coming from the right, you know, and I technically should be receiving it with my left foot, it would be a low percentage time, Benny, if I'm being honest, that I would just let it roll across and receive with the left foot because that was my weak foot. Like, why would I do this and receive it with my weak foot? So a massive deficiency on my end. And then secondly, I think at the level that I reached, which was not very high, club soccer was just getting started back in the, you know, late 80s or early 90s when I was a teenager. It wasn't all that super high level, Ben. So I could get away with poor fundamentals or poor technique, if you know what I mean. But now the game has advanced to the point, especially the pro game, where you can't get away with it anymore. If you're receiving the wrong way, you're so fucking screwed. I'll add one more thing, Ben. When I was growing up and watching all these games, because you brought it up, I would have to rewind the tape to those Argentina games or Germany games, or you name it, from the 80s and 90s. I suspect that a large proportion of the pro players back then also did not have the fundamentals that the players have now. So there would be significant violation of receiving across the body. That's my suspicion. I don't know, because I haven't rewatched those sorts of things.
Yeah. I think, Gary, that this is also the importance of training both feet at a young age. Because, for example, on my teams, at least, I only have one left-footed player, you know, and he's an attacking player, so I'll put him as a left winger. But my left back is right-footed, and so he's at a very low level. His first touch with his right foot is pretty shocking. But if you see his first touch with his left, it's even more shocking, right? And especially if you're a left back, you're getting the ball from your left center back and you receive it with your right foot, I mean, you're basically screwed. If the other team is pressing you well, you're screwed, you know? And so that's why if you're not comfortable with both feet, it's going to be shocking. I mean, to receive the ball with your right, you're basically facing your center back. You have nowhere else to go but him. So that's why I think if you're not training your weak foot at a younger age, this is a concept that it's going to be difficult for you to apply to your game.
Yeah. And we're just talking about receiving the ball. So it's right. Not a huge ask. You know, it's not like we're asking you to serve curlers into the box with your weak foot, you know, or take shots from 20 yards out with your weak foot. No, this is just receiving passes on the ground. So it's not a huge ask. It does take a lot of training for sure for your first touch to be clean with your weak foot, no question. But it's not as complicated as pinging a 40-yard backspin ball with your weak foot, you know, to your winger or something. So this is something that can be worked on your own. And obviously, because we're talking to parents here as well, if you're looking at your kids' team training environment and you don't see this stuff being trained, I would say, frankly, it's a huge red flag with respect to the coaching that your kid is getting.
Right. So obviously, Gary, there's a massive activity that we'll talk about later on with rondos that is, for me, it's fundamental in how to train this specific skill. But can you train this on your own, like receiving across the body? If you're just out there by yourself, how do you train it?
Yeah, of course, man. Obviously, I'm going to say the wall, because, you know, the wall doesn't get tired, and the wall, you know, will return a ball to you the kind of like the way that you want it returned if you give it to the wall the proper way as well. And so, sure, just stand, you know, I don't know, a few yards away from the wall, kick the ball at the wall. And if you, you know, pivot your body this way, you let it cross from the left side to your right and you stop it with your right. You kick the ball at the wall again, pivot 180 degrees, let the ball roll across your body the other way, and you're off to the races. It's quite simple. Now, you as a player, and if you're a parent who's trying to train your player and be their personal trainer, you now have to, with trial and error, be the judge of how far away the kid or the player needs to be from the wall, first and foremost, because that's going to be a function of the kid's power to serve it to the wall. You also have to judge the pace at which the kid can actually do the activity correctly. And then once you master a certain pace and a certain distance from the wall, you escalate the complication level. You know, you hit the ball to the wall even harder, so it comes back to you even harder. And you can escalate it to its limits, Ben. So absolutely, you can train this on your own.
Yeah, I think definitely once you have a good understanding of just a simple concept, then I think you could start focusing on like the quality of your first touch. Because a lot of the kids that I train this to, especially that if they're just starting out, they understand the concept, but maybe their first touch is 5 yards away from them or 6 yards away. And that's when they're going to find themselves into trouble, you know? But I think the cool thing about this, Gary, is that it really doesn't take long for this concept to be ingrained in your brain. And I know, I'm pretty sure Brian gave me this analogy. Brian taught me everything I know, but he gave the analogy of like when you're first, for example, when you're learning how to tie your shoes, like you're thinking about the steps to do it. You're thinking about, okay, I go cross, do a loop. And the first couple of times that you're doing it, you have to think about it. But then after, I don't know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks of doing it, it's just, you're not even thinking about it anymore. It just comes like second nature to you. So the same concept applies in the game. The first time that you're learning how to receive the ball across your body, you're thinking like, okay, the ball's coming from my right side. I need to position my hips, position my body so that I can receive it with my left. After, I don't want to say 2 weeks here because maybe it takes a little bit longer than that, but after a month or two of doing it consistently, you're not even thinking about it anymore. And it just comes naturally to you. So that's, I think that's for players that maybe get discouraged if they're struggling learning it at first. I mean, you just stick with it a couple weeks, a couple months, and it'll just be ingrained in your brain for the rest of your career. Hopefully you have a coach that's going to teach you this early on, because if you haven't heard this concept and you're already a high school player, like there's no chance of you making it far.
And there's levels to it too. Obviously. So you just described kind of like level one. So maybe after a few weeks of doing it hundreds or thousands of times, okay, you're getting into the rhythm. You kind of get it. Your muscle memory is building up, but obviously you're not going to be able to execute that potentially in a game under pressure. Maybe. I mean, if you're a center back, you rarely have that kind of pressure if you're building out at times. So yeah, you have time. You're not under pressure and you do it the technique properly. But what if you're in midfield, you know, surrounded by enemies, and receiving across your body you're going to be tested on it. It's probably going to take you longer than 2 weeks of doing or training it. Take you months and months and sometimes even years. And it depends on the level of play, right? Because I can take an American professional soccer player who's 20, 21 years of age and does it here in the USL or maybe even in Major League Soccer. And then I plop them down in the first division of Portugal, or I plop them down in Germany, or plop them down in Spain all of a sudden. And oh shit, you know, all of a sudden they can't execute it anymore. Because like you said, Benny, part of this is not just the concept of how to receive, but then you have to develop that first touch to when you receive, where is that first touch ending up? Where's the ball ending up? And that needs to be fine-tuned and controlled depending on the level.
Right. And once you have a really solid foundation, then you can start to get even more complex with little body feints before you receive the ball to throw off your defender, or even like one of my favorite, I don't know, I guess you could call it a skill, is to like pretend like you're going to take that first touch with your right foot and your defender steps, and then you just let the ball roll even more. Like there's so many different little complexities that you can add on to it. So again, it's like we talked about last time, it's not just a 2 month or 3 month process. There's lifelong learning that you can do, and you can continue to get better and better. Like for me, Iniesta, Busquets, like you watch their body fakes. I mean, it's just incredible. The amount of composure that they have, the timing, it's just amazing, dude. I'll have to drop some clips in here if we don't get copyrighted.
No. Yeah. It's just massive levels to this thing, massive subtleties, massive details. And I'm glad you brought it up so that parents or coaches listening don't think that, oh, it's just a simple little concept. And once you kind of get the concept, that you're good to go and done. Like, nah, man, it gets crazy, crazy.
Who do you tell me?
And also, Ben, it's sometimes it's just frustrating when coaches in particular, but players are guilty of this as well. And parents are guilty of this as well. they think that, oh, I've been doing this for 3 months already. Can we move on to something else? It's like, or it's the most frustrating thing to hear coming from those three parties, because you think you've reached a certain level for you to move on to something else. And no, bro, like, you don't move on to something else. You never move on to something else. You're always training the fundamentals, especially if you're not even a pro yet. We're talking about youth soccer and you want to move on to something else. Like, come on, guys.
Gary, it's 20 years later and Jiro's probably still fine tuning how to make rice, dude.
I believe it, dude.
Legendary, bro. So I know I mentioned that we'll bring it up, but this is a huge topic. I know it can be in its own episode in itself, but maybe we'll try and condense it. Obviously, Rondo's in regards to receiving across your body, especially in the when you're first starting the 4v0 and the 4v1s, I think this is the absolute best way to get your players to instill this idea of receiving the ball across your body. But even further than that, Gary, and again, I know you can go on for this on an hour, but you've described Rondo's as the bread and butter of training a possession-based team and something that's non-negotiable. So, and you probably mentioned this a lot already on the podcast and past episodes, but just to bring it up again, what's the importance of training Rondo's when you're trying to instill a possession-based team?
Well, what does possession mean? It means that you control the ball collectively, and obviously the collective is made up of individuals. So what do you need to do in order to control the ball, Benny? Well, the most fundamental of all is being able to have a good first touch so you don't piss the ball away immediately in possession. And so the rondos are highly effective exercises to fine tune your first touch. And this goes to the tail end of what I said moments ago, that it's very frustrating when players, parents, or coaches think that they have mastered something and they're ready to move on to something else. Like, oh, Gary, we've been doing 4v0 or 4v1 for 3 months or a whole year. Like, it's over, right? It's time. Guys, no. If we want to develop a possession-based team, you have to continue fine-tuning that first touch control. And the cool thing about rondos is that they are adjustable in size to adapt to the level of players that you have and their current skill set. And that gives you so much flexibility that as they improve their technique, their possession capabilities, you can reduce the size of the rondo. And now you've complicated life and you start from scratch all over again. What you used to be able to do for 10 straight touches without losing the ball to the defender, now when I compress the size of the rondo by not that much, maybe like 6 inches or something like that, guess what? You're not holding the ball on for 10 touches anymore. All of a sudden, it's been reduced down to an average of five touches that you keep it. Why? Because you're technically deficient. So keep working on the technique. That is the power of rondos. And I'm keeping it very simple because there are things called positional rondos that also emphasize position-specific attributes for players, depending on where you place each player in a rondo. So I don't know, Benny, like you said, we can talk about this forever and there's many different rondos that we can go into. I'd like to keep it high level. I think you want to in this episode too, but that is why rondos are key and integral part of developing a possession-based team. Not to mention that the number of repetitions and number of touches that a player gets per training exercise is through the roof compared to so many other things that you could or people actually do out there.
And Gary, there's so many different types of rondos, 4v0, 4v1, 3v1, 4v2. There's 4v2 positional rondos, double rondos. I mean, at what point, if you're a coach, at what point do you say, okay, my team has mastered the 4v0. When can we move on to the next one? Because, and think about it, Gary, most coaches don't have a team from like U8 to U18. Maybe they're only going to coach the team from U8 to U10, you know? So in those 2 years, do they just give them the 4v1 and maybe a 3v1? Or like, how can you discern as a coach, like, all right, my guys are ready to move on to the next phase here?
Yeah, man, it depends a lot on the level. It depends a lot on the age, and it depends a lot on the objectives of the coach for maybe a particular season even. So for example, maybe your team and your players don't understand transition moments. Okay. And what I mean by that, I mean, there's a lot of things, but what I mean right now by transition is that instant reaction of going from offense to defense and defense from offense. A lot of youth players in particular are really slow from a reaction perspective in doing those transitions. Oh, it's like, oh, we lost the ball. Oh, okay. I guess it's defense time, you know, and it's like a 2 or 3 second or 5 second delay or something. And then you're jogging back to maybe your position because you're out of position, or it's very lethargic. Yes. And the same thing in the transition when you gain possession, the transition to opening up space or maybe counterattacking or whatever is so slow. And so there are rondos specifically designed where that is the primary focus, the defense to offense and offense to defense transition. So as a coach, to answer your question, Benny, you kind of have to make decisions as to what you want to teach, what the team and individual players need at any particular moment in time or length of time, and roll with that. I will add, however, that, you know, once you start looking beyond what you mentioned, the 4 versus 0 or the 4 versus 1 basic foundational ones, the rondos get more and more complicated and they demand more technique from the players and more capabilities from the players. So you might say, oh, Gary, cool. Yeah, I agree. We should be doing the transition moments now. So, and you have a bunch of 11-year-olds who are mid-tier 11-year-olds, and you've been doing 4v1 for 6 months, and you do one of these transition rondos or want to do it, it's going to be a fucking disaster. Nobody's going to learn anything because your players are incompetent. They're not capable of graduating to that yet. So maybe that's part of the answer too, Benny, to your question. Maybe a coach can dip their toe into one of these more complex things. And once they realize everything is falling apart and the players just don't have it yet, well, guess what? You're going to have to fall back to the more basic stuff and keep hammering the basics until they're ready.
Right. So it's kind of like evaluating your team to see what their specific needs are, and then you can try and implement what it is that you're trying to work on. That
makes sense.
Yeah. I think also rondos typically related to, or people only think of them as possession activities, but I think what it also works on as well is that defensive instinct, you know, reading the game, the timing of when you should step and when you should not step. I always tell my players, like, think about how you feel as a defender in the middle when your teammates are on the outside and they've just completed 30, 35 passes on you. I mean, you feel like shit. And so I think it also is a massive tool in instilling in defenders, like, hey, if you want to win the ball back in the game, you need to work your ass off in the middle. I mean, I know there's that famous clip on YouTube. I won't mention the name, but these fools are putting, like, I don't know, 50 pass sequence on him, and the guys in the middle just running around wild. So I think it can also be a massive tool in working on your pressing, working on your defensive abilities, timing, when to step, things like that.
Absolutely, Benny.
What about Gary? I think one more thing on the rondos. The reason I also love it is because it kind of adds to the team culture. And what I mean by that is, like, I know a lot of, I mean, you look at any pro team, Gary, and sometimes they have their full sessions recorded, you know, on YouTube or whatever it is. What do they normally start with, Gary? It's like a massive circle keep away with like 8 players in the middle and 2. And I think it's a great way to get the team loose. And I mean, you see the players clowning on each other when somebody gets made. You know, how can the rondos help with the team culture of the team, Gary?
Benny, well, you just stole my thunder, man. That's what it is. It helps everybody have a good time, and you're having a good time while touching the ball and while, you know, warming up and getting ready for the serious training session. That's the circle keep away that you just mentioned,
right?
Which we would open with all the time too. You know, everybody's laughing, having a good time. It's a little bit of a goofing around period, but not so much. You as a coach have to kind of keep it in check, you know, let them have a good time, but don't let them be complete, you know, fuck offs. And then, once you start getting a little bit more serious, and it's not just circle keep away, but it's one of these other rondos like the 4v1, there's still that level of enjoyment while learning, but not a goofing off sort of enjoyment. It's a competitive sort of enjoyment, right? We enjoy competing, Benny, or we learn to love how to compete. So if you're in the middle, it's painful, it sucks, but you kind of learn to develop some pride in defending, okay? And that develops a culture of having pride in defending. And then if you're on the perimeter, you also are developing a culture of having the guy without the ball or the guys without the ball hate life, you know? So you develop a culture of trying to have your opponent hate life. So I don't know, just some little tidbits there from a cultural development standpoint in using rondos.
Would you ever get thrown in the middle, Gary?
Would I ever? What do you mean? Like growing up, my coaches didn't even know what the fuck a rondo was.
No, I'm saying like when you would go to Brian's sessions, like sometimes I know the coach will jump in or you fuck up and you lose the ball.
Sure.
And they throw you in the middle and fucking clown you.
No. Well, you know what's interesting, Ben, is I saw and I think everybody sees this as they grow up. You see the degradation of your capabilities and your muscle fibers and your reaction and your fast twitch and all that stuff over the course of age. So with the OSC Rage team, Ben, that we've talked about in the past, you know, I was like in my late 20s at that point or something on that order. So when I would jump into play with the Rage players, I was still fucking king and the boss of everything. Like it would be rare for me to go in the middle for one thing. And it would also be rare for anybody to fucking do anything to me when we were playing scrimmages or anything like that. I was fucking in control. Okay. And even though somebody like Prieto was more talented than me at the time and had those sorts of capabilities, you can't do anything to me. Like I'm just smarter. You know what I'm saying? And I just know what you're going to do, when you're going to do. And I know what it's just different level. But then yes, Ben, if I try to jump into the later teams, like the famous YouTube team or something like that, then I was in trouble. Cause by then I'm talking, whatever, late 30s or mid 30s or something. I don't even remember anymore. And I hadn't even played competitively for God knows how long, and playing indoor fucking rec, it doesn't count for shit. And so, yeah, dude, 100%, I'd be in trouble and be popping into the middle a lot.
No, dude, I'm only 29, Gary, but if I get thrown into the middle of the high school session, like I'm in trouble, dude. I just can't move the same anymore. They're putting fucking like 30 pat sequences on me, dude.
No, that's wild, bro. I think in my late 20s, I was still in decent sort of condition. I'll put it that way.
Well, dude, you know why? It's because we stopped playing pickup, dude. You know, I remember going every single week to play and that was my fitness, but I don't know, dude. I want to bring it back. If I start a little pickup thing, will you show up? Or is your knee fucked up?
No, my knee, bro. I'm fucking traumatized from your Asian homie who fucking let's not recount that here, man.
Yeah,
the audience doesn't care about that. But yeah. I fucked up my knee and I never went to get surgery or anything. I'm sure I had like some sort of meniscus tear. Who the fuck knows? But I recovered but I haven't really seriously tried to play since then, dude.
I know I said last thing on rondos, but two more things came to mind, Gary. One, how do you get the players to recognize the specific moments in the game that you're rehearsing in rondos? So for example, if you're rehearsing like a 3v1, how do you get them in the game to now say like, okay, this is what we've been rehearsing? Obviously the space is a little bit different, but is it you sit them down with a whiteboard and say, hey, look, this is the right back, center back, the six. This is the exact 3v1 that you were rehearsing. Or is it like in a, I don't know, 10v10 tactical game, you stop it and you have them recognize those moments? Or how can you best translate? Yeah. How can you best translate? Or does it just naturally occur?
Yeah, pure instinct, it just naturally, organically starts occurring in the games. So if, for instance, if our team regains possession, and when you regain possession, everything's very compact at that moment. You have the opponent right next to you when you regain possession many a times, or you steal a ball. Let's say you steal a ball in a 1v1 duel. That defender in the 1v1 duel is literally right next to you still. You know what I'm saying? And so your teammates who might have been there as well to press in that instance, you touch out and you go bing, 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 you know, with your three teammates there and that one defender, and it just happens organically, Ben, versus if you have not been doing these small little rondos like the 3v1 or like the 4v1 or something, you haven't developed that sort of natural muscle memory instinct to execute those sorts of things. And you can see it in games, in matches at the youth level here in the States. When I go and watch, you see an instant just like that where you can, I as a spectator can recognize, oh, all you have to do is just make that 3-yard pass there and that guy will just one touch to this guy and you're out and you're out of pressure, right? You can see that they don't do it many a times in other teams. In as you know, what they'll end up doing is the guy just stole the ball and he'll then try to like dribble out of pressure or they'll fucking do a 20-yard pass to their open teammate, you know, who's the center back or something. When you didn't, and there was no need to do that. You could have just done a 5-yard pass and go pop, pop, and you're out of pressure and it's still high up the field. So it's an instinctual thing, Ben, for the most part, in for the small-sided, very condensed rondos. Now, the bigger rondos, like the transition rondos and those sorts of things, I think you still have to verbally tell them sometimes from the sidelines during a match or during halftime or whatever, but it naturally comes out as an instinct over the course of time, in my opinion, too.
Yeah, it's really interesting how as you progress and you grow into the game, you start to recognize patterns, especially if you're a coach and you're on the sideline, you can see the game a little bit better. There's moments where the next pass or the next decision to you is so obvious, or maybe to a young player who hasn't been in these situations before. It's like you just mentioned, they'll ping it 20 yards or try and dribble out of pressure when they could have easily just given it to the center back, get it right back. And you start to see and recognize these patterns. But I remember as a young player, like I had no fucking idea what to do with the ball. You know, my first couple of games, it's like I get the ball. There's a goal on the other side. I'm going to launch it forward as far as I can. Let's go try and score a goal. But it's cool that the more time you spend on the sideline, the more time you spend watching the game at a high level, it's like these things just start coming to you and you can start to see patterns that happen over and over again and how you can easily get out of situations. And I think that as a coach, I mean, that's your job to instill this pattern recognition in your players so that they can start to make the right decisions in the game.
Yeah, you see, it's hilarious. You see the solutions, Benny.
Yeah.
You constantly see solutions from the sideline and the players don't see the solutions. And I think this is where a lot of coaches and get it wrong. They think that the players don't, quote unquote, see the solutions because they haven't been trained properly. And they think that the proper training is let them play, just let them play, right? Because the more things that they freely see in free play, that they will naturally discover the solutions and then it'll magically translate to the game. Or architect like sessions that do this fucking woo-woo nonsense of guided discovery sort of stuff. The players see the solutions as a consequence of not doing those things and actually training the way that we've been describing for the past 30 minutes. And even then, Ben, they might not see the solutions because we've been discussing a lot of technique at the moment, right? And muscle memory from a technical perspective. But to see the solutions, you have to have tactical understanding too. And sometimes the tactical understanding is a skill set that not everybody gets or has. I don't know how to explain that, Ben, all that well, because, you know, Sergio Ramos, I think it was Sergio Ramos who said this many, many years ago. He's like, you know, what's the difference between like a Real Madrid player and, you know, maybe another first division team player or a second division player or something like that is the top Champions League caliber players, they see 2, 3, 4, 5 moves ahead of time, right? They see what's going to happen, what's going to develop. And the lower level players don't see it. So I don't know why it's one versus the other, Ben. And one more thing. Sorry, I'm going on here. Then there's the other perspective of being up on the stadium as a coach and looking down at matches. And you see the solutions even more clear than when you're on the sideline coaching.
Yeah, 100%, Gary. I always laugh too when you see like somebody fucking sitting on a couch that's never played or in the stadium and they're watching, I don't know, Champions League game and they're like, what the fuck is this guy doing? Or shocking service. And it's like, bro, like, let's see you go out there on the field, dude. But yeah. the other thing, Gary, I think you learn the pattern recognition by making mistakes. I mean, think about if you're a center back and you give away a pass that you shouldn't have made and they score a goal. I mean, you're never going to make that pass again, you know? So it's just, you have to learn through not just fucking let them play, right? But you have to be in these moments, see the field, see the players, see the movements. You make a mistake once, you know, hopefully you're never making that same mistake again.
And watching high-level football for a very, very long time from a very early age, I think also naturally and organically instills a lot of these things in you, right? 100%. So that when you're on the field as a player, you're like, all of a sudden you don't do that 20-yard pass back to your center back and you're like, no, I can just go 5 yards here and just get out, bing, 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 you know? Because a lot of stuff, Ben, I think isn't trained. Yeah, it comes 100%. From outside sources.
Yeah. Oh, dude, I'm thankful to my dad because I remember I was maybe like 7 years old and this guy pulled me and my brothers out of school. He's like, hey, you know, take you guys to like a doctor's appointment or something. And we ended up like going home to watch the Champions League final. Like Barca were like, what the? Like, I was like, dude, this guy's a legend, bro. But ever since then, it's like, you know, you just as a kid, you have that desire to watch high level games and see the best players in the world do it. And then you want to be them, you know? So you're copying every single exact move that they're doing, their movements, the way that they talk, the way that they go up to the referee, like all these little things, you start to try and add that to your game, which is cool.
Ben, and I think a lot of it, again, is outside of training. It just comes with doing so much for so long that other truths start revealing themselves to you. It reminds me of, do you know who Magnus Carlsen is?
Yeah, the chess guy. Chess
yeah,
master.
The number one, the GOAT, right? And I think I listened to him on a podcast recently. I forget which one, but I've heard him speak many, many times. And he too has a very hard time explaining why, you know, he is as good as he is and why other grandmasters are as good as they are. All they usually resort back to or fall back to is saying, you know, there comes a point where you just see things, right? And it also becomes like an instinctual emotional thing that enables you to get that one extra percentage point above the other world-class guys. And I don't think it's something that can be trained, you know, Ben. Training can only take you so far, structured training. And then there's this other intangible, yeah, that comes into the mix.
Right. Yeah, just getting that repetition in of watching games, being absorb yourself in the game, you know? I think that's the best way to learn, best way to get better. The last thing,
everything, Gary, everything. Yeah, all the ingredients in the soup, everything, and even throw genetics in there too. Maybe there's some sort of genetic thing going on with certain types of humans that gives you that tiny little extra boost above others. I mean, what makes Messi Messi? No fucking clue. Like the best of the best in the world, they're like, he's just different. He's special. And it wasn't training. I can tell you that much. There's something else going on there.
Now, dude, I heard a few, massage the baby's like left ankle every single day. And this one's going to have a mean ass left foot, dude.
That's what you're going to do with your kid. I could already see it now, dude. You're going to be doing all kinds of experiments.
Sick, dude. My son will be a guest on the podcast in 10 years, dude.
Love it, man. Love it. Are you going to tattoo his fucking left leg too?
All black, dude. Like fucking that shit.
Oh, man. You can just tell him it was a birthmark.
100%, dude. Okay, the last thing I was going to ask you about Rondo's is, what is your response or rebuttal to, obviously, U.S. soccer says, you know, they don't recommend Rondo's because they think it's not directional and it's not game-like. So, what is your rebuttal to that? Fuck them?
It's just fucking stupid shit that they say. Number one, we already discussed why they're incredibly important and incredibly good. And the actions that you're doing in Rondo's happen all over the field. at all times, you know, constantly receiving across the body, you know, opening your body posture accordingly, you know, connecting pass, developing your foot sensitivity, your first, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So on its face, it's already a stupid thing that is being said about rondos aren't good. Being directional, does fucking kicking the ball against the wall, is that fucking directional? You know, should we tell kids not to fucking kick the ball against the wall? That it's the stupidest thing fucking on earth. And secondly, how are you going to show me the set of activities that are all like directional, for instance, and are going to develop the players with all the things that we just ended up discussing? You show me that and I'll be like, oh, okay, well, I stand corrected. But it's just not true, Ben.
Why do you think they went away from it, Greg? Because I remember you told me at one point in the actual U.S. soccer courses, they were like showing clips of you guys doing rondos and you guys' possession-based team. Why do you think they went away from it?
I don't know. Why do bureaucrats and politicians, you know, do the things that they do? You don't have high-level soccer people, for real soccer people. If you have an A license or something like that, that doesn't make you a soccer person, in my opinion. You're in the soccer ecosystem. You have a soccer job, sure. You may have been working in soccer for a very long time. It doesn't make you a soccer person. For example, if you've been in the restaurant business for 20 years or something like that, and you've been a bartender for 25 years or something, it doesn't make you a fucking like restaurant person. Like I embody restaurant. You know what I'm saying? No, you don't embody restaurant. It's just a fucking job to you. So we have a lot of these types of folks making decisions and in positions of influence here in American soccer. They don't bleed the game. They don't live the game. They don't know the game. So it doesn't surprise me when they fucking pick up any old cockamamie trendy thing to say, and then say, oh, we're going to fucking train like France now. We're going to go to the French fucking courses and send all our coaches to the French fucking stuff. Okay.
All right, dude. I triggered you again. I love it.
But this is true. But did the restaurant analogy make sense? Like in any profession, it's like some people, it's just the job. You could be a doctor for 25 years and be a good doctor and practice and do all these sorts of things, but it's not your fucking passion. It's not like you bleed medicine. You know what I'm saying? It's not like you're fucking thinking about research and how to fucking do all this stuff all the time. Nah, you go and fucking conveyor belt of patients and you try to whip them out as fast as you can and prescribe as fast as you can. And then you go home to your family and you have your life outside of medicine. Great. I'm not fucking reprimanding you or anybody in any profession for having that sort of life and posture. Awesome. But you don't fucking bleed it, you know? So if you don't really bleed it and live it and embody it, you're not the right one to be deciding policy and fucking how to teach this stuff and how to develop the next generation of practitioners that can go above and beyond you or world class, or you want to make somebody world class. What the fuck do you know about world class? It's just a job to you. You don't live it.
Right. Well, the interesting thing to think about, Gary, like to go back to your doctor analogy, you know, obviously you say a doctor can be in its profession for 20, 25 years and they're not passionate about it, or they don't have this burning desire to get better. But, you know, think about maybe when they first started, you know, it's like, oh, I want to become a doctor. At that point, Gary, they are investing 20 hours a day, like passionate, burning. But then by the time they get to, I don't know, 20 years on the job, then it starts to just become this kind of robotic thing where they're just going through the motions and they don't really care anymore. You know, it's the passion is gone, you could say. I think in football, if you're truly passionate about it, like that passion never goes away if you love the game and that much.
And some folks say they have a passion for it, but they don't. They don't. Passion means it's all consuming. And yes, you have to make time for family, for friends, for all the stuff that's not the passion, but it's there. It's going. Right? You're at a family function or you're, you know, doing things other than your passion and it's still processing in your brain. And you find yourself kind of I don't know what the right word is. You find yourself kind of being in and out of the moment of this other function that you're currently at, and you're going back to your passion while being in that other function. You feel me? Like, that to me is somebody who is possessed by the subject matter, is possessed by the profession. And the ones who are possessed are the ones who are like, they have, we were just talking about what makes a player special at the super elite level. You know, there's Sergio Ramos talk, and it's the possessed ones who are end up being world-class at something.
Yeah. Okay. Like I imagine like Pep, Mourinho, like, I don't know if these guys are married or not, but I can imagine like they're at dinner with their girl or their wives. Like they're fucking thinking about the game tomorrow. Dude. They're not, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I'm sure they're going to be trying to be there in the moment, but in the back of their mind, like these guys are running through what drills they're going to do or their team talk, you know, for them, it never stops.
Didn't it come out that Pep was getting divorced or she asked for a divorce or they got divorced? No, I think somewhere I heard something like that. We'll have to look that up. But yeah. I know, because I have folks that I know personally as well over the course of the years that are of that possessed, passionate type, and they're outrageously good at what they do. And yeah, it takes a toll on your relationships. 100%. Like, how can it not? And just like I don't blame the folks who aren't like that, I think folks who are just regular people, which is commendable, should not look down upon and demean the folks who are embroiled in the passion either. Yeah. Because I see it so often. Oh, and I hate to bring up Elon Musk again, but he's just such a prominent figure in modern day discourse, and everybody knows who we're talking about. But people look at him and try to denigrate him. Oh, look, no work-life balance, you know, or anybody who's like world-class, that, not anybody, a lot of folks who are world-class, they always point the finger out, look at that fucking idiot, doesn't understand work-life balance and doesn't, you know, he's ruined his life. You know, he doesn't know what it's like to be in the moment and family and all the things that most folks say is the most important thing. And I don't disagree with him either, but unfortunately, guys, that's what it takes. It takes these outrageous outlier special humans to advance civilization or advance a particular domain. You can't have fucking balance, Benny. If you have balance, you're splitting your time up in all these different arenas. You cannot be world class for the most part. It's going to be, you have to be a superhuman.
Yeah, no. And Gary, people don't want to hear that. You know, people want to just have everything handed to them, and they look at outlier cases like, oh, look at Messi, look at Ronaldo. These guys have families with his wife, kids. He's a family man. He could still be the best in the world. I can do that too. But if you want to be truly special, you want to truly be a master of something, Gary, I mean, you have to invest everything, dude. Like I looked up right now, it's Pep divorce. The headline, Gary, this is from January 20th, 2025. Pep and his wife, Christina, reportedly decided to break up after having Kent's dinner in Barcelona. I'm telling you, dude, so I was thinking about the game or I don't know. She's like, hey, babe, you're not here with me. What the fuck? Or, dude, seriously, I don't know. Man. This guy starts losing and then his girl's out, dude.
Oh, damn. He had a bad season. Now she's fucking toast. She's out of here.
No, oh, dude, she's going with Arteta now, dude.
So crazy. So and Ben, like folks say, like, oh, look at Messi. He's a family man. Stuff. What the fuck do you know? You have no idea. You have no insight. You have no insight into his actual life. What it's like. You don't know.
No, they see.
You see Antonella. Okay, there with him at the games, and they smile and kiss on the cheek, and everything looks hunky-dory, and it looks hunky-dory on Instagram. But everybody listening to this knows what you see on social media isn't real life. If it were real life, you'd be like, holy shit, looks like everybody has an amazing life right now. Look at everything. And in reality, as soon as they fucking post that picture and stuff, they're fucking miserable people.
Yeah. Nah, dude, they see one clip of Messi in the, and I'm not saying Messi's not a good guy or like a family man, but sure, they see a video of him playing with the dog and the kids in the backyard. They're like, wow, like it's going to make so much time for his family. And, you know, I could, but think about it, dude, probably like I mean, I know he's been with Antonella for a long time, but imagine in the early stages of their relationship here. I mean, this guy was like fucking living, breathing football. I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe he spent like an hour of time with her at the end of the day, but no, this guy was completely invested in. So it's hard, man.
Yeah. It's tough. And look, all I'm saying is just from my personal experience and then from reading stuff, because you don't know what's true and what's not true. But it seems like when you read biographies and autobiographies and, you know, testimonials of people who have done a lot of things in life at that outlier level, that this whole notion of balance that we perpetuated is a myth. I'm sorry, man. The CEO of X, Y, or Z corporation that's doing cutting world, cutting edge sort of things, you don't live a normal life. You don't do a 9 to 5 and come home and prepare dinner, you know, and are, you know, with your kids the way that a normal person does. It's just not true.
Right. And Gary, I don't think you're saying like, there's nothing wrong with not being that type of person, right? There's
no,
if you want to be like just a person who has a family and has a job and has kids, like, okay. But I think people have a misunderstanding of what it takes to become the best in the world at something.
Yeah. And sometimes it's not even best in the world, just like being really, really good,
you know,
or even that is going to take sacrifice. There's a reason that the word sacrifice makes so many appearances in whether it be biblical or scripture or in philosophical works. Sacrifice is real, man, because we only have a limited amount of time. So if you want to do X, you have to give up Y. This is just the law of the universe. It's conservation of energy, Benny. You can't have both things. You can't have your cake and eat it too, as they would say. And yes, I agree with you. There's absolutely nothing wrong. And in fact, maybe the smartest ones in the world are the ones who are kind of like, nah, I'm not going to do that crazy shit. I just want to chill, have a peaceful life, you know, not have the outrageous highs and lows of being an entrepreneur or trying to be a professional athlete or stuff. Nah, I'm going to sacrifice that life, you know, so I can just fucking chill, watch my Netflix, you know, go out to a restaurant with my family. And again, maybe those are the wise ones. Maybe it wasn't wisdom. It was just a good choice.
Yeah. Gary, we went on a massive tangent there, but that's okay. You know, I know we're supposed to be talking about the tactical lessons within the masterclass, but like you always say, we went from tactical lessons to is Pep getting a divorce or not, dude.
No, but that's great. It's great. I think it's great. I think all of this ties, it's all connected.
Right. Yeah. Like you say, man, everything is connected. But I think in future episodes, Gary, we can continue on with other concepts within the lesson, such as, you know, building out of the back, losing your man, defensive pressure, attacking patterns. But I think most importantly, I think the reason that you added these within the masterclass is so parents, not only so they can have a good understanding of how the game is played on the global stage at the highest levels, but also to discern whether your son or daughter is in a good training environment. Because if you show up to training and you don't see any of these things, I mean, maybe they're only touching on one of them, but if they're not implementing these concepts within their sessions, I think it's probably not the right environment for your son or daughter. If you want them to play at a higher level, or everybody has different goals, you know, for the parents that you just want your kids to have fun, you know, maybe, okay, a recreational level, it's the right spot for them. But if your son or daughter has that goal that they want to play at the highest level, then these are the things that you need to be looking for within the team training environment.
I would say so, Benny. And folks like to look at exceptions and point to exceptions, but I'll repeat it for the benefit of everybody. Exceptions prove the rule. So if there is an environment, a coach, a club that doesn't do the things that we just finished discussing and are in the programs, but they have a track record of having players graduate to the next levels and all this sort of stuff, great. Don't always think that you are the exception or your circumstances happen to be the lucky 1 in 100 exception to the rule.
Right. Gary, how does promotion relegation tie into Pep getting a divorce?
Okay, let me think about this one. It makes perfect sense, because if there is no promotion and relegation, the level of intensity, the level of competition, the level of demand that exists on a coach or a technical staff is greatly attenuated, much, much smaller. So if you're a coach in like MLS or something like that, if Pep were to come to MLS, he doesn't have to be at the top of the table at the end of the season. He doesn't have to be, Benny. He could. He doesn't even have to be top four at the end of the season to make the Champions League or something like that. He could just fucking chill his balls off all season long and maybe come in, you know, eighth place, you know, out of 12 teams or something, and make the playoffs, and it's a successful season, and the fans are not on your ass. Ownership is not on your ass. Nobody's on your ass. And so all of a sudden, you could have a great work-life balance, and you can fucking please your wife as often as she likes, and you're good to go. But overseas, that doesn't exist, motherfucker. Overseas, it's for the real ones, and the real ones cannot have work-life balance. You can, but guess what? You're fucking fired. You're going to be fired so fast, bro.
Any married MLS coach, dude, if promotion relegation comes, they're screwed, dude.
Oh, man. Well, that's why a lot of folks don't folks who are currently, so folks who currently benefit from the monopoly and having what we just described don't want competition. They don't want it. So they advocate for things to stay the way they are, 100%. And that just doesn't go for coaches. It goes for all the folks who are shit at their jobs and employed in the ecosystem. Because if it got opened up, everybody who is shit at the profession, shit at their jobs, you're going to get exposed really quick. So nobody wants that shit. Reporters, you don't fucking want the open ecosystem, because reporters, as they exist in this country, they are owned metaphorically and literally by the monopoly. And so all of a sudden, if the monopoly doesn't exist anymore, you aren't protected anymore. The monopoly isn't going to get rid of that other journalist or reporter or content producer or whatever, because they're not peddling the monopoly narrative. No, they're going to be allowed to stay in, because it's an open market. And now that reporter, that journalist has added real competition, probably competition for people who actually know football versus them. So they're fucked.
Good way to end it, Gary. Good stuff, man.
All right, brother. Good.
This might be one of my favorite episodes, dude.
Well, hopefully folks stick around to the second half of the episode. In the first half, we're talking about rondos and soccer and technical stuff. But the second half is the interesting half for me.
Dude, there's a hardcore 343 loyalist out there that these guys watch. Dude, it's crazy. Within 20 minutes of publishing an episode on YouTube, Gary, I mean, there's consistently already like 75 people have already watched it. And you know they're watching until the end, because they're always bringing up comments and stuff like that. So it's badass, dude.
Cool.
I love it.
Cool. So maybe we are building up to eventually be able to do a live stream.
I think so. That would be awesome.
All right. Well, so to the hardcores, hey, share this stuff to everybody in your circle. Get them hooked on it too. And then I think it will not only improve your environment over the course of time, because the philosophy that you now you share with us, they're going to start acquiring that same philosophy. And then you guys are going to be aligned. And then secondly, yeah, let's bump up the numbers, and we can eventually have a live stream and add that sort of level to the episodes.
Perfect, dude. Hey, so I'm going to try and probably maybe publish this one early, or maybe I could just set it as a premiere, because I'm going to be in Hawaii on Monday, dude. I'm going to be there Sunday night, so Sunday to Thursday. So maybe what I'll do is before I leave, I'll just set it to publish on Monday at like 7 a.m. or something.
Yeah, that's fine. That's 100% fine. Let's make sure we do that too, so that we remain consistent. Maybe we can even crank out the other one as well, or at least have it prepared. Is that possible?
Yeah, 100%. That sounds good.
Cool,
maybe,
man.
I'll do a quick recording in Hawaii, dude. Maybe like a 30-minute one.
Hey, that'd be good. Yeah, that'd be cool. That'd be cool. That way you can be divorced too, like Pep.
Sounds good, dude.
All right, Ben. Have a good one, man. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.